We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives, but can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now welcome your host, Jen Lumenlund.
Hello and welcome to episode one of Your Parenting Mojo, which we're going to call The Importance of Culture, or Why Don't We Shame, Blame, and Murder Our Kids? I'm going to start by asking a question. Have you ever thought about how common the murder of children has been in societies we now call Western in the past, as well as in societies all over the world today? I recently read a book called The Anthropology of Childhood, Cherubs, Chattel, Changelings by David F. Lancey. And it's really a tour de force that describes attitudes to children across cultures today and also in history. Lancey describes how, in a variety of societies, from the Olmec to the Aztecs and the Greco-Romans, children were sacrificed to gods to bring in rain and to function as intermediaries between the divine and the human worlds. And in other cultures, the infant is viewed as threatening in its own right or as a vessel or an avatar for ghosts and evil spirits. In Micronesia, women might give birth to ghosts, deformed children who were thrown out to sea, or burned, or buried. And cannibalism actually still survives today in certain places in New Guinea, where infanticide isn't considered an immoral act because birth practices are repulsive and dangerous and a newborn is demonic rather than human. Neglect might have even been more frequent in the cross-cultural literature than deliberate killing, even if the end result is the same. A study in Hungary found that mothers of high-risk infants breastfed them for shorter periods than normal infants and also smiled at them less often and played with them less frequently. And they became pregnant more quickly following the birth of a high-risk infant. It's almost like they had scaled back their investment in the high-risk child and acted as if they didn't believe it would survive. Children have been and continue to be in many places regarded as property and material goods, as well as a source of income for families. Slavery is one obvious form of this, but children were also sold into the army. In the U.S. Civil War, one boy who was age 15 was bartered into the army by his stepfather as a substitute for a man who paid the stepfather a horse, a bridle, and a saddle. As recently as the end of 2012, the United Nations reported that 175 Malian children were bought from their parents for more than $1,000 to serve the Islamic insurgency. Chinese mothers sell babies to orphanages, which resell them to eager, adoptive, often American parents. Shifting gears a bit, in many Western cultures, either ancestors or elders, certainly adults, occupy the top of the pyramid of importance in a culture, with adolescents near the bottom and children at the very bottom. Which is to say that it's actually pretty remarkable that in the couple of hundred years or so since children were usually to be found working in factories, earning money for their families, that in weird countries, defined as Western, educated, industrialized, rich democracies, children are now at the top of the heap, dictating our social and cultural structures as we subvert our needs to theirs. Until the 19th century, there was no need to cherish an infant or help it develop. The death of a child was really no great cause for sorrow, and newborns were often referred to as it, or a little stranger. With the Protestant Reformation came the sacred duty of parents to rear children for a blameless life, and then the Victorians used dress and hairstyles to create these androgynous, angelic little innocents. In Japan, children had been seen as utilitarian until after the Second World War, where they were romanticized as cute and dependent and needing much tender care. By the 20th century, infant death became cause for public concern, and the fight to limit parents from earning a return from their children had strong moral overtones. Neglect began to replace the fatalistic God's will as the most common postmortem victim after a child's death. Incrementally, possibly without anyone even noticing, weird cultures have shifted from the adults being the most important to the children. I just want to pause here for a minute and say that this podcast is a little bit different from most of the ones I'm planning for the future, but I wanted to start off with it because I think the historical context is so important to understand. The thing that really struck me most in Lancey's book was that things I take for granted, a child's right to not be hit or even shamed, the desire to do the best for your children and help them achieve their fullest potential, is not only not the way that everybody parents, but hardly anybody has parented that way throughout history, and even today it's not a given. What I didn't realize was that virtually every choice I make as a parent is determined by my culture, Although I find myself in the privileged position of being able to select what aspects of that culture I believe are the most important and even borrow episodes from other cultures if I choose. I'm also privileged because the vast majority of scientific research in weird countries is conducted on white children and parents, and so it's probably at least somewhat applicable to my parenting style. Parents in other cultures, even within the US, may parent very differently. Shirley Bryce Heath's seminal book called Ways with Words chronicled her years living in and near two poor rural communities in North Carolina. And she noted that in the black community, Tracton, children don't expect adults to ask them questions because children aren't considered appropriate conversational partners. And the most common kind of question asked of young children in Tracton was an analogy question, which calls for an open-ended answer drawn from the child's experiences. And it's designed to test the child's ability to see things that are similar in their environment. The adults use a lot of metaphors and similes in their own conversations, sometimes even comparing the children to something else. An example that she gave is, "You act like some monkey." So the questioning develops a skill that's critical to fitting in that particular culture. And this is so different from the popular press aimed at white parents today, which encourages parents not to compare their child with others so as not to damage their self-esteem, because every child is different and childhood isn't a race, so every child will get to where they need to go at their own pace. The parents of many toddlers will have weaned by now, either because the milk ran out, like mine did, or due to cultural pressures. Others may still be nursing, and the decision of when to stop and who decides when you stop, whether it's you and or the child, and how to stop, is one for which there are many approaches. Lancey says that Central African foragers actually apply hot pepper to the woman's nipples, which is apparently quite effective. Providing stimulation to our babies and toddlers in the form of physical contact and the language of mother ease, where we speak slowly and in a high-pitched way. Playing games like peekaboo to accelerate physical and intellectual development are all a cultural decision. In many cultures, including the Inuit, nobody speaks to the child until at least the child is able to speak for himself. And even then it's ignored, because when it does speak up, it has nothing useful to add to the conversation. In other cultures, children defer to elders, rarely initiate topics of conversation, and only take very brief speaking turns. Adults are to be treated with deference and respect. Children don't express opinions, and adults are hardly likely to ask a child for their opinion. North American mothers tend to talk to and stimulate their babies to encourage the baby's development as a unique person, while Japanese mothers comfort and lull babies and see the baby as an appendage. Psychologically, the boundaries between the two of them are quite blurred. North American parents want their children to be popular with peers and well-liked by family and friends, and are willing to do a lot to make that happen. Whereas in East Asia, high academic achievement is the primary objective, and the child should willingly forego popularity for exceptionality. People also control their children's behavior in different ways. I loved an example from the Goni, I think that's how you say it, N-G-O-N-I, of Malawi. The quote from Lancey's book was, "A proverb might suddenly be dropped like a stone into a pond. The conversation rippled away into silence, and the boy or girl who'd refused to share some peanuts or had been boasting began to wonder to himself, 'Can that be for me? No? Yes? It is me. I am ashamed.' No one said anything, but the shamed one took the first chance of slipping away to avoid further public notice. The use of proverbs was an effective way of making the child learn for himself and apply the lesson." The Japanese also use shame as well, as attention is called to filial obligations when children misbehave. Something like, "When you do that, it makes mommy sad." Corporate punishment is still common around the world, from Morocco to Peru. The rarest strategy of controlling behavior, favored in weird societies, is reasoning with children, which may not be as effective at controlling behavior, but does at least give some early preparation and negotiation skills, and also facilitates the development of the parent as teacher-pupil relationship. Cultural issues have really broad implications for the way that we transmit knowledge to our children. In many cultures, children are simply expected to sit quietly and watch and learn, and they do. Whereas middle-class North American parents set up learning situations with educational toys and pretend play and adjusting everyday activities like baking a cake to help a child learn how to cook. Another ethnographer who observed the Warao people, I hope I'm saying that right, in Venezuela, said that by the age of 3, all children know how to maneuver a canoe perfectly. It's truly breathtaking to observe a 3-year-old child push off and paddle a canoe across an enormous river in full control of the craft. I know I assume that everyone teaches their children things they think the children should know. But in the vast majority of non-weird cultures, parents don't believe that knowledge must be crammed down children's throats. Instead, the children will either learn because they want to, or because the physical or social consequences of not learning are too great. In most places, teaching is done for the benefit of the caretakers, to make the children easier to deal with rather than for the child. I've been reading a lot about scaffolding lately, which is the process of providing assistance to children to help them complete tasks that are just outside their current range of competence. Lancey undercuts that by saying that elaborate scaffolding is rarely seen in other cultures. No one wants to waste time teaching novices who might well learn in time without instruction. Play provides an alternative to adult scaffolding. One thing I haven't seen in the ethnographic literature and other cultures is the concern for the children's emotional well-being that I believe characterizes much of our interactions with our children in weird countries. We're moving away from hitting and ridiculing and shaming because of the emotional consequences both for the child and later the adult, whereas I haven't found any discussion of this at all related to other cultures. I wonder if the adults resent the treatment they received as children. If, like the college grads hired by investment banks in the US, they simply look back on the experience as character building and perpetuate the same treatment on the next generation because, well, why not? Or at least until the millennials came along anyway. So what I'm going to do to tie all of this up, which is the same thing that I plan to do at the end of each of the future podcast episodes, is to say, what the heck does all this mean to me? Why do I even care whether a 3-year-old in Venezuela can paddle a canoe? My challenge to both myself and you would be to recognize all the decisions that you make on an ongoing basis and just notice, not judge, just notice the influence of culture on these and then think about what's the message I'm sending with what I'm saying or doing, and is that the message that I want to send to my child? Dr. Dan Siegel, who wrote the books The Whole Brain Child and No Drama Discipline, did a great podcast as a guest with the group 0-3. There's a link for it on the blog page for this episode, where he talks about parenting on automatic pilot. He says, you're aware you're saying something or doing something, but you didn't really choose to say it, you're just doing it. And if you're not conscious about how your own early experience shaped you, then whatever was said or done to you ends up just being passed on down to your kids. Then the interviewer makes a joke about why your parents push your buttons, and the answer was because they installed them. So what I encourage you to do is be conscious of the things you're saying and doing and just notice for yourself whether or not these things are in line with the values you want to establish for your children. So for example, when you're at the dinner table, do you insist on your children sitting up straight and keeping both wrists on the edge of the table when their hands are not being used for eating like the French do? Or do you mostly ignore the children as you converse with the rest of the family, instead expecting the youngest to learn by watching? I'm not the manners police here. I'm not here to say that one thing of doing things is better than the other. I'm just describing two potential extremes that are currently practiced in different cultures today and wondering, how do I fit into this continuum? And is what I'm doing likely to lead to the outcome that I want for my child? Some other examples. When you're working on one of your hobbies, how do you handle your child's interest in the subject? My 2-year-old daughter, Karis, is fascinated by cooking, and in the past I've set up opportunities for her to cook. When we ran out of granola, I would set up the kitchen, ingredients, and bowls so I could guide her through the process of making granola. As I mentioned in episode 0 on philosophy, I've been using an approach to parenting called Resources for Infant Educarers, which is also known as RI, or Respectful Parenting, and that advocates for not showing a child how to play, which is essentially what cooking is for Karis. But RI advice officially runs out at age 2. And I'd had a hard time finding any information or anyone doing anything different beyond that age other than providing these educational approaches to enhance the children's development. But now I see in the grand scheme of things, this is actually really uncommon, and providing her with opportunities to simply watch me cook and then later take on some of the simpler tasks herself would be just as much of a learning experience as the more elaborate setups that I'd been doing. When you're around children who are playing and the play starts to get a bit excited and maybe a bit aggressive, will you intervene, or will you step back and let things play out? Will you encourage sharing by forcing a child to give up a favorite toy to a playmate or by modeling sharing behavior? And how will your own behavior be shaped by the expectations of your family and friends and even strangers at the park? I know I feel the need to put on a bit of performance when there are people watching. As always, the references for this episode are on my website at yourparentingmojo.com. Just go to episode 1, The Importance of Culture in Parenting. I'm looking forward to the next episode, where we'll be talking much more about the difficult topic of toddlers and sharing. See you next time.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift, 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.